Monday night game recap edition of the pod tonight. Got some great games to talk about. Charlotte, San Antonio, awesome Charlotte comeback. Also Milwaukee and Detroit, which featured a buzzer-beating putback by Andre Drummond. The Wizards blowing out the Hawks in the fourth quarter in Atlanta to move into pole position in the 538 playoff odds in the East. And the Warriors and Wolves going down to the wire as well. Joining me to talk about all these games, Danny LaRue.
That was a pretty fun Monday slate of games. I mean, Mondays can be inconsistent, but this was one of the better ones I can think of in recent league pass and it was pretty much all league pass. Oh, no, never mind. Spurs, Hornets wasn't.
Oh, because it was on NBA TV. NBA TV is like the same as league pass anyway.
It's complicated. I don't count it for LPA, but yeah, it's very nebulous.
Well, it's kind of annoying. NBA TV is really the one thing that you can't actually get streaming.
Correct. Even if you have access to it, like I do, you know, I pay and have access to NBA TV, it's still hard to get.
Yeah, that's something the NBA needs to fix, is that should just be available on Watch TNT or whatever it is, because Turner does NBA TV, obviously. But anyway, let's talk about that game. Hopefully enough people were able to see it since it was on NBA TV. It started so inauspiciously for Charlotte. They were down 28-7. I tweeted out at the end of the first that it was just an absolute evisceration, like one of the most dominant quarters that we've seen all season. The Spurs were just absolutely in the Hornets' heads. They shot 5 air balls in the first quarter. It was a totally miserable performance, and then they just slowly, inexorably made their way back.
Before we get into the comeback, the stat that was most jarring to me about that first quarter was Charlotte committed more turnovers than they had made baskets and made free throws combined.
That's bad.
It's real bad. Yeah, it was. They had 5 turnovers, 3 made baskets, and 1 free throw. Insane. I don't think I can never recall having that happen before.
No, it was not a good quarter. I think I want to say it was the lowest scoring quarter by anyone all year. Although I could be wrong about that. I thought I remembered seeing that. And I mean, San Antonio wasn't exactly dominating, especially offensively. It was still a lot of long twos. That's what Charlotte wants to give you. They want to pack the paint. They want to take away threes. But the Spurs were hitting those long twos in the first quarter. Tony Parker had 14 in the first half. A lot of those on mid-rangers when Kemba Walker was kind of going under the screen and Parker was working into a range where he felt comfortable. LaMarcus Aldridge was hitting some shots early on. But what really I thought was the key to the entire game for Charlotte was that their bench unit, which has been one of the best in the league with guys like Lynn and Lamb, severely outplayed the Spurs bench unit, which has actually been performing at an all-time great level so far this season.
And the Hornets have done a really nice job building their bench. We've been at moments critical of how they have generally played shooting guards in the starting lineup that have been worse than Jeremy Lamb, just for various reasons. But part of the benefit of that is that you get to have him against second units, and he has done a very good job, and Jeremy Lin was fantastic in this game.
Yeah, he had some really tough shots late. Jeremy Lamb, too, I thought was really the guy who sparked their comeback on defense, which is surprising. He has always had great tools. That was really the big selling point for him coming out of UConn, was his length, and he actually put it on display in this game. He had a couple of block shots in that stretch early in the second quarter when they were able to get back into it, get, I think, within 10 with that reserve unit. He got out in transition. That was big for Charlotte as well, was getting some stops, getting some turnovers, and getting in transition. That really, and you could tell that one of the edicts from Clifford was for guys like Kaminsky and Zeller to really run the floor as hard as they could, because that's something that really none of the San Antonio bigs are particularly speedy in transition. That's one way that they actually can be beaten, and Charlotte got just enough on the fast break to end up being pretty darn efficient over the last three quarters.
And one other thing I wanted to note is that when we were talking about the idea, when I mentioned the idea of Lamb being better than their starters, that was before they got Courtney Lee, who was great in this game.
Yeah, he was. He did not close the game because Lynn was so good, and that was actually a difficult dilemma for Clifford with Lynn and Lee, both of who probably played better, but Kemba Walker is their near all-star. You probably got to say he's got to be out there too. But it looked like he pushed the right buttons. He went with Kaminsky instead of Marvin Williams down the stretch as well, which I was critical of, although Marvin kind of banged his knee and he may not have been available. I think Marvin's a much better player than Kaminsky, but Kaminsky was able to do just enough, not screw up defensively, and Charlotte was able to come away with the win down the stretch. And what do you think of this game from the Spurs' perspective? Was this simply a matter of them taking their foot off the accelerator, or do you think they kind of just lost this because they weren't as good as the Hornets in this game?
Well, it seems a little bit weird to take your foot off the gas pedal after you have, like, I would have thought that would have been an early letdown, and when you dropped that kind of first quarter on a team, and I think it even got to 30-7 because I think they scored the first few points of the
second quarter. Yeah.
You don't really see that, but one of the big factors that swung the game was I think San Antonio either didn't have a turnover or didn't give up any transition points in the first quarter, and then they ended up with 16. So they ended up, you know, getting to a more normal number, just doing it in three quarters instead of four. And when you talk about big men beating them up and down the court, transition is a big part of what makes that possible.
My takeaway from the Spurs, and I was definitely so impressed with what they did defensively in the first quarter especially, is that I just don't think this offense is that good. And now some have suggested that what they're doing is they're trying to get more of kind of an ISO-heavy game, slow the game down. That is their strategy to beat the Warriors. They went to a lot of post-ups in that game on Saturday. So you can make the argument that that worked, but this team just does not have the shooting that they once did. They do not quite have that beautiful ball movement. They're not just shredding teams up with backdoors the way they did at one point. And it's just a lot of mid-rangers. I mean, you look at their three biggest usage guys on this team are Tony Parker. It doesn't really get to the rim as much anymore. You know, it's a lot of mid-rangers, and he can kind of get hot on those, but then, you know, he's not really getting to the foul line. He's not really shooting three, so it's hard to be efficient on those shots, even though he's okay at them. Kawhi, another mid-range artist, and LaMarcus, a mid-range artist as well. Now, they're going to avoid turning the ball over most of the time because they can just get the ball in those guys' hands and let them make a play. But if you're really talking about an offense that's just going to punish teams the way some of these previous units did in their heyday, I don't think we see that anymore from this team.
And the Warriors at full strength have pretty good personnel to handle that sort of a thing. They'll still turn the ball over and they'll create some of those mistakes themselves. And if you're going to go with a mid-range heavy approach versus a team that shoots a lot of threes, you're going to have to be a whole heck of a lot better at defending the three-point line and making your shots than they are.
It also shows some of the limitations of a team. LaMarcus actually was taking threes last year with Portland, not a ton, but it was about 10% of his shots. I think he hasn't made one yet this year for San Antonio, and it does show your limitations. Even if you have guys with a lot of talent, that when you do not have a three-point shooter at the four, and Boris Diaw as recently as 2 years ago was one of those guys, just shooting 40% from three-point range and shooting them with no hesitation in that beautiful 2014 run that they had. Now it's just hard to get enough efficient shots. Now, I mean, this is a good offense. You know, I think they're in the top five and have been basically all year, but they're not really going to be able to put their foot on teams' throats offensively the way they do defensively. And this is still a wonderful team. I mean, they're not some terrible team now because they lost to Charlotte or, you know, I mean, they've still been great. I think this does have some implications for them going after the number one seed, which we can get to. But it was a little bit troubling for San Antonio. But on the other hand, if Danny Green hits any of the four wide open threes that he took, and he was 0-for-7 overall in 21 minutes, we're thinking about this game a lot differently.
We are, and he's going to have to make some of those shots, though that's not why he's on the court necessarily. His defense has been solid this year. It's just that the shooting has been a focus. One thing I wanted to mention about with Diaz, his percentage this year is all right. He's at 38.5, which is good, but how many he's taking has dropped pretty precipitously. He's shooting less than half of what he did last year in less
Yeah,
minutes.
He just passes up so many wide open
right.
threes,
and
too, just watching him.
And that's a big factor, because if you're going to respect somebody at the line, part of that is that you think they're going to take the shot, and part of it is that you think they're going to make it. And so if you're passing those shots up, eventually, especially the smartest teams, will either force you to take it, or they'll do something to use that to their advantage.
Kevin Martin played a little bit in this game. Jonathan Simmons did not play. Martin still doesn't really seem like that much of a Spurs guy. I wouldn't anticipate that he's going to help them a ton in the playoffs, although he did appear to be kind of playing harder. But overall, the Spurs, 4 of 17 on threes. I mean, it's not even the percentage. It's just that 17 is just not enough attempts if you really want to be an elite NBA offense.
They also only shot 13 free throws.
Yeah, so 13 free throws, 17 three-point attempts. You know, unless you're just getting every bucket at the rim, which these guys are not, then it's tough to be an elite offense. What did you think of Kawhi Leonard's performance. I thought Nicola Batum was amazing on him, and Batum also had 15 points on 9 shots in this game.
You mentioned this during the fourth quarter, that his offense, he's not at the same level offensively because it's so much easier to make him disappear. And, you know, he's a different player. We talked about him a lot in the top 10 players thing, and his offensive value is, he's more of a secondary guy than a primary guy. And of course, he's the defensive player of the year, so you have that there. But that is a big weakness if nobody else can step up to the plate in the way that they did, let's say, in their heyday.
Down the stretch, they really just did not go to him at all. And then once they finally did, there was a play where Batum was fantastic. They tried to run an ISO for Kawhi. Batum fronted the pass from the wing. They threw it to the top. And usually if you're fronting the pass from the wing, when they throw it to the top, you're sealed and you're on the backside, or you're on the front side and you can just throw it right to the guy. Batum was able to get around again. And then they threw it back to the wing and he still was able to deny. They had to throw this long looping pass, which Kawhi then was able to catch and shoot a shot, and then Batum still contested his shot and made him airball it. It was really one of the better defensive individual possessions that I've seen all year, and Batum actually blocked another one of Kawhi's shots. Not something that you really see very often. Batum was able to avoid getting bumped off by Kawhi's strength and then was able to use his great length to contest in a way that we really have not seen anyone do on Kawhi this year, to my recollection.
Yeah, the way Batum was playing him, it made me think that they had done a playoff series against each other, but from what I recall, Portland never played San Antonio in the playoffs.
No, they did.
Oh, they did?
2014.
Oh, you're right. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, after
they beat the Rockets.
After the Lillard. Yeah.
Okay, so then that gives to some of the experience of knowing where to be on Kawhi.
Yeah, I mean, that was obviously a far different Kawhi. And actually, someone tweeted at me today that Kawhi needs to start getting more buzz for most improved player. I think that he and Steph are probably would be my one and two in that area. I guess CJ McCollum you could throw in there as well. But I think to take the leap that both of those guys have taken this year when they already were really awesome, I think that that's more impressive. Let's talk a little bit more about Jeremy Lin's night. 29 points on 19 shooting possessions, 4 of 4 on threes. He was just fantastic, just made tough shot after tough shot in this game, other than the threes, which were all kind of wide open shots from the top of the key.
Yeah, he had a big basket late that I remember it was a fadeaway on the right side. And, you know, it's a tough shot. I think it was over Tony Parker, so that made it a little bit less tough. But he's done that in the past at moments. And when Kemba is having an off night, it's really nice that you can have somebody else in that team who can both create for himself and create for others. And Jeremy Lin can do that. We said when he signed there that it was a little bit surprising to us, but they've made that fit with the two of them together work.
Yeah, and you have to imagine that he is going to get paid pretty well. I mean, Kemba had only 6 points in this game, so Lin was able to pick up for him. And I had praised Lamb. This was usually the opposite of what he usually is. Usually he's great in the box score, but not as good in the floor game. He's great in the floor game, only 1 out of 5 from the field, but he had 7 rebounds and was a well-earned, I thought, plus 10 off the bench. Frank Kaminsky, another guy who was plus 8, even though he was only 2 for 9, and then Al Jefferson was plus 5, despite being only 1 for 9. So I think offensively, Kaminsky actually defended reasonably well in this game, although he's just totally hopeless around the rim if there are any big guys around. And his 3-point shooting, you know, I think to be a really valuable guy, he's got to shoot 40% on threes, and he's in the low 30s last time I checked. So those guys really on the bench played good D, but they just rode Jeremy Lin's coattails essentially offensively.
Yeah, and I chuckled a little bit because we've talked before about the idea that we both support about having back-to-the-basket bigs play against second units because they generally have the competitive advantage. And I cracked up a little bit because when they brought Al Jefferson in, I think it was the end of the first quarter, Tim Duncan was still in there. And I'm just sitting there like, that's exactly what we're not hoping for. But I mean, it was still the right sub pattern. It was just that Duncan happened to still be in.
Big Al, not exactly looking too svelte these days.
No, we can say that he's still recovering from a lower body injury. So I give guys a little bit of leeway as they have a little bit less mobility.
I mean, but that's like, it is possible to not work out at all and not gain any weight, right? Like, you just have to regulate your intake. Now, maybe NBA players are used to eating a ton of calories because they have activity, and it's hard to just go from that to not eating as much. But nonetheless, there are plenty of guys who come back from injury and haven't gained, you know, it looks like he's put on like 20, 25 pounds, and he really has like quite the spare tire.
And he's going to be a free
around
agent.
The midsection. He is, And also, I bring it up not only because, you know, from an aesthetic standpoint, but because there were tons of times in this game where either he just didn't quite have the explosion to finish his shots inside, rebounds would just be a couple inches out of his grasp, and it definitely did seem to be weighing him down. And especially when you're coming off of a knee surgery, you would think you want to keep your weight as low as possible. I'm probably being too negative on Charlotte, though. Another guy we should talk about who had a great game was Cody Zeller,
yeah,
with 14 rebounds, 4 on the offensive end. He was good at pushing the pace, played pretty well defensively. So really, I mean, it was Zeller, Batum, and Lynn were the big guys for Charlotte.
I don't mean this just because they're both tall white guys that play hard, but there is this weird parallel between Cody Zeller and Mason Plumlee that there are guys who I bet both their teams kind of wish they could upgrade at the starting center spot, but they're doing a really respectable job on competitive teams.
Yeah, and Cody has the short arms. He's not amazing finishing at the rim. He's not amazing protecting right at the rim, but he plays really hard. He sprints the floor. He's very mobile in pick and roll defense. And so while he prevents guys from even getting the opening to get to the rim in pick and roll or with his mobility to get over and help, and I think he's been a pretty valuable player. He's someone who Hornets fans booed, or I guess it was Bobcats fans at that point when he was selected number 4 in 2013. And I didn't think that was the greatest pick in the world, but he, especially in a top 10 that was littered with landmines, he actually has turned out to be a totally serviceable player and someone that they probably will look to extend this offseason.
Yeah, and they have the precedent with Michael Kidd-Gilchrist of getting a guy, you know, who has a little bit of a higher cap hold and, you know, using that to get some security. So, they'll have an interesting negotiation with him because there are a couple other big men in this class that will be talking at around the same time.
Yeah, and this Hornets team now, especially now that they've traded for Courtney Lee, they've got a lot of good players on this team, right? I mean, Al Jefferson, a guy who was an all-star coming off the bench, you know, didn't play that well today, but still a quality player. Kaminsky, at least a guy that teams are guarding from three, even when he's not hitting. I mean, that's kind of the biggest thing. He, oddly, for a rookie, teams are actually really guarding him out there, and even though he's not shooting the greatest percentage, so that has its own value for him, even though he's not hitting that shot. Lynn, obviously a guy who's had some great moments in the league, and Lamb has matured into a quality reserve as well. You know, not to mention even Spencer Hawes, who isn't my favorite, but hasn't been horrible this year. He's getting actually a DNP in this game.
They also have Steve Clifford, who I think deserves heavy Coach of the Year consideration. He's done a really good job. And yeah, I could see Charlotte, if they can get on the opposite side of the bracket from Cleveland, I could see them winning a series or two this year.
Yeah, and I really enjoy watching this team play.
Except the way they moved
the ball. Yeah, that's right. I mean, they were just so flummoxed in that third. Like, they probably threw like 4 or 5 passes to guys that were open that just, you know, threw it at their feet or threw it behind him. They just, I don't know whether they're just really tight or the Spurs pressure, like it took them a little while to adjust to it. I think you said that. But credit to them and credit to their home crowd as well for sticking with them and helping them get one of the great wins of the year.
Well, we didn't really talk about it after the Warriors-Spurs game, so I'll make the point that I made on Twitter, which is that the Spurs are really smart and they have good hands in a way paralleling the Warriors. And so what that means is that the passing windows that you're used to aren't the same. They aren't the same size. And so what you see a lot against a team like that when you play them once is that first quarter, you make a pass because 95% of the time it's there, and it gets tipped, and the Spurs are also really good at reacting to that, and so they were getting turnovers, and so I said they had those 5 turnovers. I think there were a couple of those that just generated easy buckets, and there's really no way to prepare for that because if your team can't do it, there are only a couple in the league that can.
Let's move on to Detroit and Milwaukee, but before we do that, I want to tell you about our new sponsor, the Postmates app, available for iPhone or Android, whatever your pleasure. Basically, you can get anything delivered from any store in any major U.S. city to your house. When we're watching football on Sundays and we don't want to leave and nobody wants to go out and pick something up, our favorite restaurants don't deliver, doesn't matter. Postmates will take care of us. You can even get delivery from something like Chipotle. If it's not food, you can get some items delivered from like a 7-Eleven whenever it's open, or a Walgreens. Really, any kind of item, food, convenience, doesn't matter. Postmates will deliver it. And if you use that familiar CapSpace code, all one word, you can get $10 off your first delivery. That'll cover your first delivery. And remember to use that code, because that'll mean that you came from us, and they'll continue to advertise on our show, and you'll continue to hear the dulcet tones of Danny LaRue in your earpiece. And now let's hear the dulcet tones of Danny LaRue talking about the Detroit-Milwaukee game. What were your initial thoughts?
Does Jason Kidd feel sympathy for Andre Drummond? Is that why he only shot one free throw in this game?
Yeah, there were a few putbacks that he got, especially in the fourth quarter, where Danny has this habit of watching games when teams are up three, and as soon as they bring it inside the arc, he'll just start screaming at the TV, "Foul him! Foul him!" And I'm sure you were saying that on a couple of those late offensive rebounds.
Well, yes, I was. I mean, it's just an expected value proposition. It's more egregious in college basketball. I was screaming it with more intensity during the NCAA tournament. But yeah, it's just there. A lot of the worst case scenarios aren't there when you do it, and when you have somebody on the floor like Andre Drummond, it's a whole different value calculation because he's not going to make two.
Yeah, this is a game that the Bucks really should have won. They shot 54%, but they really lost it in the other categories. They shot basically zero free throws in this game. I think they had like seven free throw attempts. They are 5 of 10 on threes. Great percentage, not enough attempts. Obviously, that we know that's going to happen with this team. And then they're out rebounded 10-5 on the offensive glass, and that enabled them to lose this game, despite the fact that Detroit only shot 43%.
Yeah, and I thought one of the places to go with this was just the idea of how ridiculous the sub patterns were for Milwaukee in this game. And I tweeted about it and Seth Partnow at almost exactly the same time. And something we noticed was that Milwaukee didn't make a substitution until about 30 seconds left in the first quarter. And so we've talked about sub patterns plenty of times on the show, and the theory behind a bench mob, let's say, where you're going to do kind of a mass substitution when you play the guys 11 and a half minutes to start the game, you're going to probably have to do that, is when your starters have really good chemistry and you have a second unit that makes sense with each other. Well, the guys that didn't start for Milwaukee in this game did not play well together.
No, they did not. And they brought out units featuring Tyler Ennis, John Henson, and Miles Plumlee together, Jared Cunningham, and Damian Inglis. And those guys were all well into the red. Henson was negative 17. Cunningham was negative 17. These are guys who played, 13, 14 minutes. Kidd was somewhat saved for himself in the crazy minutes that he's been playing his starters, just because Jabari and Chris Middleton both got into foul trouble a little bit. So Giannis played 37 minutes, and so did Jared Bayless, but they at least didn't get those guys into the high 30s and 40s, which we've talked about on the show before is a little concerning. But when you see how bad the bench is, and think of how many guys are out for this team now, Michael Carter-Williams, Rashad Vaughn was inactive, Grievous Vasquez, OJ Mayo, all the guys who were supposed to be playing off the bench on the guard line, and a lot of the guys that were supposed to be able to take three-point shots on this team, too, are out. So you can't blame the Bucks for just, guys like Ennis and Inglis, Cunningham. Those are basically replacement-level guys at this point. But considering this is a lost season for the Bucks, they don't want to push the minutes too hard. Still, they just absolutely should have won this game. And I think for both sides, it was, despite the heroics with Andre Drummond getting that tip-in with 2 seconds left, it was just a very ugly last 3 minutes of the game.
It was. One thing I want to add in from a little bit earlier, we were discussing it, is that the Bucks only made 4 free throws in this game, and that's there have only been 3 games this year where a team had less than that. There were twice. Atlanta and Chicago each had 3, and the Warriors actually had 1 against the Sixers in that game in late January this year.
Yeah, maybe to quote Kevin Pelton from that all-time NBA rank podcast we did last week, which you guys should listen to, by the way, if you haven't yet, I think it was just a mutual non-aggression pact where the Bucks agreed not to foul Drummond and the Pistons agreed not to foul the Bucks at all. That's the only way you can explain some of these numbers. We talked about the bench. Milwaukee actually led 36-19 in this game, and then they pretty much immediately gave up an enormous run to where it was just about tied at halftime. That was started by the bench. But I want to get to the last, 3 minutes of this one. Were you watching this live?
I was.
Yeah, it was just, every possession was just so ugly. They were getting into their offense with, 12 seconds left on the shot clock. There were a ton of missed free throws. There were non-subs made by the coaches. It just, everything that you want to see in a sloppy end of game existed here.
Do you want to?
Oh, and there was a 4-minute replay review for like no reason, where the screen that Ken Maurer was looking at was like totally blank the entire game, the entire yeah. time too.
Do you, so one of the things that you noted that was really kind of striking to me was that on some of the defense only possessions, Miles Plumlee and John Henson weren't even in the game. They used Greg Monroe.
Yeah, those were. Oh, by the way, it was John Goble, not Ken Maurer, by the way, but who was staring blankly at the screen. But yeah, I mean, they had Monroe in on these defense-only possessions, and defense-only possessions where they're up. You know, the Bucks were up 5, they were up 3 in the last 2 minutes, and Detroit got a couple of nice buckets at Monroe's expense at the rim. Reggie Jackson had a drive that cut it to 1, and right over Monroe, Tobias Harris, who on a baseline out of bounds beat Jabari Parker, didn't get any help from Jared Bayless, and then Monroe wasn't able to get over there, had to just foul him. And then Reggie Jackson had another drive to the basket where Giannis reached for no reason, and then Reggie was wide open for a floater, but Monroe was in position for a block of that floater that probably, you know, 60-70% of NBA centers send that into the first row, and Monroe just wasn't able to do it. You look at Monroe's line, he was 18, he had 18 and 10, he was plus 16, he was 9 of 15 from the field, didn't get to the foul line at all, obviously, because he was on the Bucks in this game, but I just felt like still they are a better team with a more traditional kind of plugger center, someone like Plumlee, and who I think should be getting more of an opportunity for this team.
And those problems are exacerbated when in late game situations you choose to also have Jabari Parker on the floor, because Jabari Parker, while he is doing much better offensively, is still not a good defensive player, so you don't have a guy who can clean up the messes. And so the one that really stuck out to me was when there were 30 seconds left, Bucks were up 3. You know, I think, yeah, they still had enough timeouts from whatever. They could have made it a defense-only possession, and they had both Greg Monroe and Jabari Parker on the floor. Surprise, surprise, Detroit gets a big bucket.
Yeah, and Jackson drove past Jabari Parker on the switch and then scored right over Monroe at the rim on that play. That was concerning. And, you know, we talked about how terrible that Bucks bench lineup was. What's the one thing that Monroe does well? Well, he scores, and he can score in the post. So why not play him with those guys instead of playing Miles Plumlee and John Henson together? That really just does not make any sense at all. I mean, those guys both have no shooting range at all, and neither does Tyler Ennis. And Inglis and Cunningham aren't really guys you respect either. Like, a big shocker that the lineups featuring those five guys couldn't score at all.
And Monroe's probably the best facilitator on that second unit, too. You can just run everything through him. He can be the hub.
I agree with you. On offense, Milwaukee, Chris Middleton had a wonderful game. He was 11 out of 16, 2 of 4 on threes, 27 points. Fantastic game. But the last four possessions of the game, really, that the Bucks were trying to score, it was 1-2 pick and roll, get Reggie Jackson switched on to Middleton, and just have him ISO. He actually scored 2 out of those 4 times, amazingly. He missed a shot and committed an offensive foul on the other 2 and hit 2 tough setbacks. But the process there, while he hit those 2 tough setbacks, the process there was pretty miserable, and they were even lucky to score those buckets that they did.
Yeah, so do you want to go through the last possession or two?
Yeah, I think that it started when, you know, on that Reggie Jackson shot that made it 91-90. The Bucks then immediately inbounded the ball, and Detroit smartly, instead of fouling right away, trapped, and about 5 seconds ran off. The Bucks had to take a timeout, but because they had then inbounded the ball already, they had to take another timeout to advance the ball. And so that it used up 2 of their 3 remaining timeouts. And then once they're in the front court, there was a weird snafu where the ref gave Giannis the ball late, or Giannis like let it fall to the ground. The Bucks had already started their play. Reggie Jackson did a great job of just holding Chris Middleton, which wasn't called, and the Bucks had to burn their final timeout. And then once Jared Bayless missed both free throws and the Pistons scored, they still had 2.1 left, but because they'd used all 3 of their timeouts, they just had to inbound it to Middleton, who had to throw up a desperation heave from beyond half court with 3 Pistons all over him.
Yeah, so and that ended up swinging the game, because if you have a timeout, there are 2 seconds left. It's not super likely that you're going to get something great, but at least you give yourself a fighting chance to generate some sort of look.
Yeah, the Bucks' defensive rebounding has obviously been a huge bugaboo all year. On that last possession, Kidd actually did go with John Henson because they were switching everything. That worked initially. They forced KCP into a tough 3, and they're only down 1, so that 3 was a pretty miserable shot. But Drummond was matched up against Giannis, and Drummond got inside position, got the easy tip in, But even then, Jabari Parker was just standing at the free throw line. Like, how many times he, the power forward on this team, nominally, will just stand at the free throw line and not move to go get the ball on a defensive rebound just kills me. Especially when you see Giannis engaged with Drummond. Tobias Harris blew past Henson. If the ball had caromed off to his side, he would have been able to get it. It was really just ugly rebound. And then, you know, you would have liked for Giannis to be able to foul Drummond, but to react that quickly yep. when you're up one is probably unrealistic.
That's too much to ask. Play, but with Jabari, I get you and I both get a little bit crazy in those circumstances when there's nothing to be lost by going for the rebound. You know, it's not like you're setting yourself up for some sort of weird play. If you get the ball, you're probably going to win or you're going to get a foul. And if they get the ball, there isn't enough time to probably kick it out. And your guy probably isn't going to be the one who's making that difference. So if you can even bounce that ball in the air, that's probably enough to get you the win.
Also, we would be remiss in not mentioning Marcus Morris's fantastic game. 8 of 9 from the field, 4 of 4 on threes. Really the only Piston who was remotely efficient in this game. He had 21 points on 10 shooting possessions. Really just a fantastic offensive performance from him to keep the Pistons afloat when really nothing else was working for them.
One other injury note from this game, well, not from this game, but Jody Meeks, it was reported that he's going to be out probably for the remainder of the regular season with an undisclosed shoulder injury. They're not ruling him out for the playoffs or anything like that, but that's what I've heard so far.
Yeah, and that matters because this is a Pistons bench that has struggled, especially now that Steve Blake is back to being the backup point guard. They're not going to go against this horrendous Bucks bench every game by any means. And even, you know, Stanley Johnson is going to be the beneficiary, and he has been struggling from the field. He is 1 out of 6 in this game, missed a couple of wide open corner threes, and then passed one up and went right into a charge. Really had a couple of bad offensive plays, and, you know, Stan took him out right after that, and I think he was telling him, all right, you got to shoot that. I think the Pistons bench is back to being a liability. I mean, the four guys they played off the bench were Blake, Stanley Johnson, Anthony Tolliver, who is hitting his threes and he's a quality backup four, and Aaron Baines. Those are the four guys who are playing.
You ready to move on to the team that our friend Tim Bontemps is calling the Walking Dead?
Would that be the Washington Wizards?
The team that refuses to die, or that dies and keeps getting reanimated. I think both analogies are fine.
Have they won 5 straight now?
Yes, first 5-game winning streak of the year.
Yeah, so what are, and they really just waxed the Hawks in the fourth quarter. Lots of people had a great game for them. They lit up what had been a wonderful Hawks defense for these last couple of months. Where are we at now on the playoff odds for that 8th seed? I think everyone else is above 90, but then except for the Wizards, Pistons, and Bulls.
So right now, the Wizards are actually the 538 odds leader at 42%. The Pistons are at 39%, and the Bulls are at 33%. And one factor in that is the schedule. And so Detroit, after tonight, only has 2 more games the rest of the season against sub-500 teams. That's bad.
Yeah, the Pistons would have been in big trouble if they had lost this game tonight. I'm sure that's a game that the odds expected them to win. The Bulls were at home against Sacramento and kind of eked one out down the stretch against them. I mean, I think, especially with them having won 5 straight, that has coincided with, surprise, surprise, Bradley Beal actually being healthy, getting back in the starting lineup. Nene is playing well for them. Markieff Morris has started to settle in, especially defensively. Bulls forever had a good post today on how he has actually really helped their defense quite a bit with just a little bit more versatility and strength and rebounding than, you know, some of the small fours that they had out there before were able to provide. So I think that this team is by far the most dangerous, and just based on how they're playing, I think the Wizards are playing by far the best of all of those three teams.
And Washington, about half of their remaining games are against teams that are either dead or dead adjacent. So they have the Lakers, the Kings, the Wolves, the Nets.
Who is dead adjacent? Who do you? I think our listeners would love to know a team that you are defining as dead adjacent.
Minnesota's been feisty. I mean, they nearly beat the team that's going for 72-10 tonight. I'd say they're dead. I mean, their playoff chances are dead, but they're still playing well. And not New Jersey. Wow, that's a throwback. Brooklyn will have Rondae Hollis-Jefferson back for the 2 games they still play against Washington.
Yeah, actually, this is probably a good time since you just made that mistake, and I think I've definitely made that. We have had 2 errors on recent shows. Danny, you said that the blocks record was 12. It's actually 17.
Correct.
By one Elmore Smith in 1974. And then I said when I was talking about the Spurs and Durant that Kawhi, LaMarcus, and Parker take up $40 million in cap space. I added up 14 million and 16 million to equal 20 million. That is incorrect. They actually take up 50 million cap space, but the Spurs still could get Durant. The rest of that analysis was good, but I just had that wrong. So
there is a life lesson here, which is try not to Google records on your phone while you're doing a podcast, but it is absolutely my mistake and I own it.
Let's get back to this game. Brad Beal was dominant. He had 25 points on 15 shooting possessions, had four threes in the third quarter as the Wizards were able to push the ball. John Wall was magnificent in transition, really looked to have some pretty good bounce to him as well, had 14 assists, was setting up corner threes as is his wont. And the Wizards overall, 13 out of 25 on three-pointers, and that was one of the big differences in this game, is they hung a $117 on this Hawks defense.
And as you mentioned earlier, Washington generally has looked pretty good when they've been close to full strength, and I think Markieff Morris is helping them.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, he's not been that efficient, but he did hit two of his three threes, and he is also a solid passer. When he plays with Nene, the Hawks, for whatever reason, were doing quite a bit of trapping on the pick and roll, even when it was Wall involved. And he was able to throw it to Morris, was able to throw it to Nene, especially in the second half. And those guys were able to make plays coming down the lane, finding shooters, shooting jump shots from 17 feet in the case of Markieff at times. And the Wizards offense just looked really good. I mean, obviously their shooting was fantastic, and that's not going to happen every single night that Brad Beal is going to go 5-6 on threes and John Wall is going to go 3 out of 5. But these guys have some decent talent at the offensive positions once you get that shooting of Brad Beal on the floor to open things up just enough for everyone else.
They also had a really strong advantage on the boards. They out-rebounded the Hawks by 11 on the aggregate and 9-2 on the offensive glass.
Yeah, 9 offensive rebounds. That's actually probably less than the Hawks will usually give up. But you know, that's 7 more possessions still that the Wizards had in this game when they're playing so well. And the Hawks started off shooting well from three, but then they cooled off a little bit, still were 40%. But I thought that the Wizards' defensive strategy overall was sound, and that strategy was, we are just going under on the pick and roll every time with Jeff Teague and Dennis Schroeder, and that we're going to make those guys beat us. And Teague had a nice game. You know, he got to the foul line 8 times, but was 3 of 9 on 3s, 7 of 17 overall. Not someone that killed them. And Schroeder also was a 1 of 3 on 3s, so 12 of those 33 attempts were by kind of below average shooters, and I think that's what the Wizards really were hoping to get.
Yeah, is that, I'm just trying to think about if this Wizards team is as close as they've been to full health this year. And the Hawks, the only guy that was listed on their injury report is Tiago Splitter, though Kirk Heinrich didn't play.
Yeah, as a quick aside, that trade, especially with how Sheldon Mack has been playing for the Jazz, I mean, I don't think he's the solution as the starting point guard for the Jazz, but he's always been a capable backup, certainly. And he was under contract, non-guaranteed next year for like $2.4 million for a team that really has to make a decision between Schroeder and Teague and could very well trade one of those guys either during this summer or at the trade deadline next year. Keeping around Mack for next year on a value contract probably would have been a smart move. Heinrich is a free agent. He's not playing at all now either. And they also gave up Justin Holiday in the deal as well. And you certainly would have rather just had that Jazz second round pick than Heinrich if he's not going to play either. So a lot of that didn't really make much sense for the Hawks. On the other hand, a move that we derided as making no sense during draft time has looked pretty darn good these last three games.
Tim Hardaway's getting buckets. He followed his first two games with 20-plus points as an Atlanta Hawk with, I think, 16 tonight. And, you know,
on 8 shooting possessions, by the way, 4 of 5 from 3.
Yeah, I mean, he's a guy who can do that. The criticism for him has been both kind of creating for others and his defense, but he can do that. And the other, I have to defend my criticism of the trade in the sense that you're not getting as much value because he's going to be a free agent much sooner, so you don't get the value of the years on the rookie scale, and because what they, you know, getting him, I don't think anybody, even with positional value with the guys the Hawks have, would rather have him than Mason Plumlee, who has the same basic contract structure, but is, you know, was traded for a lower pick.
Yeah, that's a good point. Although with Splitter in the fold, it's not like they really needed another big at that point. They had not made the move for Splitter. Although it wouldn't shock me if there had been some discussions about that beforehand.
Really?
Since I think that, yeah. Since that move occurred like right on July 1st to pick up Splitter for nothing. Yeah, I don't know. I thought that the Hawks have been playing well. I don't put too much into the fact that they lost this game. The Wizards shot crazy well. I think it's more just a good win for the Wizards than it is the sky is falling for the Hawks overall. I mean, I think they do still have some structural difficulties, especially if Kent Bazemore is kind of falling back to earth a little bit, as ironically Hardaway has been rising. Thabo Sefolosha played 30 minutes. He's still a real offensive liability. Schroeder, I don't really trust his shooting. Same thing with Teague. But I still think that they are going to struggle against switching defenses. And I think that Washington plays them well. I'm not sure yet how to feel about the Hawks going into the playoffs. I think the matchup is going to be huge for them. But this one game doesn't make me feel any better or worse about their chances, really.
We talked about the bottom of the Eastern Conference playoff picture, but today's action, the Hornets getting a surprising win and the Hawks getting a moderately surprising loss, really makes that compelling again. It's going to stay compelling, but so the Heat, the Celtics, the Hornets, and the Hawks are all within one game in the loss column, and I think we both expect Boston to fall back as long as Jake Crowder is out, but
yeah, although Olynyk is back, yes. And he's actually been, and also I think that just their scheduling, they played the Sixers and the Magic at home these last couple of games, but yeah, the Celtics have a super late West Coast swing coming up, and if Crowder isn't back, that could get pretty ugly for them.
But so yeah, those four teams are incredibly close right now, and that seeding really matters, because assuming Cleveland ends up holding off Toronto, which is now closer than it has ever been, it's one game in the loss column, you get on the, if you can get the three, you get on the opposite side of that, and you get home court in that series. And especially if, let's say Boston, who I would argue is one of the more competitive teams at full strength of those four, if you can get the three and get them on the opposite side of the bracket with Cleveland, that would be fantastic for whatever team can make that little push.
I mean, it's not impossible that Boston could fall all the way to seven.
Yeah, because Indiana has a freakishly soft schedule this year.
Yeah, I mean, they are projected for like 45, and Boston's projected for 47. So I think there's very easily, if Boston can't find their form, or if Crowder misses more time than we expect, they could go all the way down to seven, which would be pretty amusing for them to get the seventh seed after having been the third for so long. And that might be a pretty ugly first round matchup for Toronto as well, a matchup that we would have thought we might see in the second round as the 2-3. But that's, we can focus more on that as it comes into greater focus. Let's talk about a team that we really have given short shrift to all year, always last in the podcast, per usual, the Golden State Warriors.
Yeah, what? I think today will be less praise than we usually give them, but my kind of, I guess you could say my big takeaway and with this, and it's been true, is that other than what I think against the Knicks, of course, that's also against the Knicks, they haven't really played, the Mavericks game. They haven't played super well since Andre Iguodala went out.
Yeah, other than just those home blowouts against teams that were just totally overmatched. I mean, what happened in this game, I thought a few takeaways. Number one, Steph, two bad games in a row, really for the first time that I can recall this year. And when he wasn't quite himself, he had that shin injury that he was dealing with. Today, I thought he just looked like he was out of gas. He totally lacked burst off the dribble. The Wolves, following the Spurs game plan, basically switched everything at all times, and they were putting Karl Towns on Steph. And Towns actually in the first matchup, although Steph dropped like 45 on him in the first matchup, Towns did a decent job on him switching out, but Gorgui Dieng would switch out him, and Steph would just, wasn't even trying to take those guys. Even when he would be wide open on occasion, he like double clutched one that just would be no hesitation normally. But Draymond Green is the one who saved the Warriors in this one.
Yeah, he played a really big game, and a lingering thing that you and I haven't discussed very much, but if it keeps on going, will be a story with this team, is that Harrison Barnes is not taking advantage of the situations that present themselves to him.
Yeah, we talked about this in the wrap up on Saturday, that he just is not beating power forwards who are guarding him, and when the other team can now put a wing on Draymond Green and switch that pick and roll with a lot less consequences. Now, Green was able to kill Ricky Rubio and Tyus Jones in the post in this game. I think every single one of his field goals was in the restricted area. He was 10 out of 13, 24 points, six assists, 9 rebounds, 3 steals, 3 blocks. He also was unbelievable defensively. He was the only Warrior who was playing any defense in the first three quarters. It was really just a wonderful game from him, and his intensity, this was one of those heartbeat games that Kerr likes to talk about. And at least Curry, when he was not hitting his shot, was able to focus on playmaking, and he did have 11 assists, which was one of his higher assist games in this one.
If Draymond Green is the heartbeat, does that mean Anderson Varejao is the flatline?
Oh, man. Yeah, I was quite apoplectic when Varejao came in. He was, of course, a team worst -7 in this one in his 10-19, which is becoming a trend. Yeah, he and Ian Clark were playing together in the fourth quarter, and it was the big three, Clay, Steph, and Draymond, Varejao, and Brandon Rush for, like, from the six-minute mark to the three-minute mark. And finally, Kerr came in with the real lineup, bringing in Livingston and Barnes, and that lineup closed it out as the Warriors just locked down the Wolves to the tune of 15 points in the fourth. But yeah, I mean, Varejao, as soon as he came in, he gave up like three buckets in a row in pick and roll. I mean, it's not all his fault, obviously, but, you know, he's not able to switch the way that the rest of these guys are. He can't stop anybody at the rim, and he's not mobile enough to get out on shooters. You know, Karl Anthony Towns hit a couple of easy pick and pop jumpers on him, too.
There were a couple of big late plays that I think we'll talk about, and the one I want to start with was Harrison Barnes. I think he either airballed or near airballed a three, and
No, it hit the rim. It was like off. It was just like a normal miss, a little bit off left.
And
yeah.
Stephen Curry, right place, right time. It seems like that happens like once or twice a game.
Yeah, he ran in from the three-point line. There were no other Warriors in position. They're up two with like a minute left on this shot, and you thought, all right, this is a wide-open three for Barnes. He usually hits this. You know, of course he didn't because he hasn't been playing well lately. But Steph just ran in, I think, from the right wing and just kind of snuck under the baseline, past three Wolves, got the offensive rebound, and then when he got it stripped out of bounds, the Warriors ran a great play, got the switch, and Draymond Green hard cut on a baseline out of bounds for a layup, and that was really the key bucket in the game, putting them up four with a minute left.
The other one like that, it's not a big play I want to talk about, is he set one of the most illegal screens I can remember, where it wasn't a screen, he just shoved Ricky Rubio and ran the other way, and they didn't call it.
The Wolves played a pretty good game, especially offensively. I mean, the Warriors' D was not good. But the Wolves did as well as could have been expected for trying to force the Warriors off the three-point line. They held in only 24 three-point attempts, which is not a ton for this team. They did give up 13 offensive rebounds, which was partially a consequence of all the switching that they were doing, getting their bigs way out on three-point shooters. James Michael McAdoo had four offensive rebounds, and Draymond had four offensive rebounds. So that hurt them a little bit. But I thought they did as well as could be expected. Sam Mitchell did a good job of managing his timeouts, with one kind of weird exception in the first quarter when Towns was posted up on Curry and he called it. But aside from that, he kept the game within reach, but they just could not score in the fourth quarter. And I thought the biggest reason was just that Andrew Wiggins did not look good.
He settles way too much. And we talked about it a little bit with Harrison Barnes, and my hope with Wiggins is that both his skill level will improve and so he'll change his expectations, but also, you know, just growing in the league to know that a 20-footer is not a good shot, especially when you're not making them, but pretty normally, especially if it's off the dribble, you can probably do better than that. And there were a couple of pivotal possessions late where that was the look that they got.
Yeah, it really started when Towns was out of the game and the Warriors bench unit made a nice run at the end of the third and beginning of the fourth when Wiggins was basically the only guy trying to create every time. And it was just him trying to spin through eight guys and getting stripped. It was him pulling up from 20 off the dribble. And the one time they actually like went to him in the post, like he's really good at the post. Like that's where they need to get him the ball more. And ultimately, Wiggins did have 25 points, but it took him 26 shooting possessions to get there. And somehow he only had one turnover. I don't know how that was because and he had played 41 minutes in this game too. Towns 38, Levine 39, Rubio 32. So Sam Mitchell, another one of these, you know, going for the win. I support it a little bit more against this all-time great team. That'd be a really nice win for these guys. And they're young, so it's not the end of the world that they played so many minutes. But yeah, I still think that Wiggins, I don't know, he's just got to be able to shoot better and he's got to be able to get some better shots, or at the very least, be put in better position to succeed than he has been.
I wouldn't be able to live with myself if I didn't mention Ricky Rubio's shooting night. He was 5 of 9 from the field. He was 3 of 7 from three, which is a lot of threes for him. And I think at least one of his other two-point makes was a close one, and he was from deep. He was 7 of 7 from the line. So you need that kind of a performance, and Towns played a pretty good game, and it just ended up not being enough. And we were both impressed. I guess impressed is the right word, that Minnesota didn't go for a quick two at the end when they were down, I believe it was that they were down four with about 15, 20 seconds to go.
Yeah. Now, they did go with Tayshaun Prince instead of Gorky Deng. Deng was, although he was only 2 of 7, he was +9 on the night, and they'd been playing well with him on the floor. Tayshaun Prince, in his 20 minutes, was -14. And you'd say, all right, you know, we got to have someone more mobile in there. But the Thunder, for example, have guarded Sean Livingston in that small lineup with their center. And there's no reason that you can't do that. Sean's not going to shoot outside of 15 feet. He's probably easier to guard with your center than half the guys in the league, unless you're talking about getting out in transition. So Deng could have easily guarded Livingston. And Deng is just such the superior player to Tayshaun Prince at this point that he probably should have been in there. But I don't think that's ultimately why they lost. They played pretty well. But the Warriors just know how to win these kind of games. And, yeah, it was obviously yet another clutch performance win for the Warriors.
Yeah, so the Spurs game was another loss from within five with five or less left, right?
Did they get within five? They must have.
I think they had
to. Yeah, so they're probably like 25-2 or something in those games now.
Sounds about right.
That's pretty remarkable. Another reason that you might give Golden State the edge against San Antonio is the way they've been able to play in the clutch. And Steph clearly didn't have it tonight. It's a little concerning. They are now have more games coming up. They are playing on Wednesday and Friday at home. I mean, that Wednesday game flying back is not going to be a picnic. That's against the Clippers, though, and I think at home that they'll get enough energy to beat them and probably beat Dallas on Friday. But, yeah, Steph has got to get right. I mean, and watching him these last two games, this was what, they just finished a 6-9 stretch here. But he sure looked like a guy who might need to be rested. But they also really want to set the win record. And as time has gone on, they've gotten closer. The quotes coming out of there, Steph was saying, oh, yeah, you know, why do I want to set the record? Because you're still talking about that 95-96 Bulls team 20 years later. Draymond saying it's something that they really, really want. So I don't know. We'll see whether they end up pushing too hard. I mean, I guess the good part of it is that their matchup in the first round isn't going to be as hard as it would be in previous West years. So that they can kind of relax a little bit there, and they've got some easy games at home at the very end of the year against like Memphis.
So the Warriors,
but we'll see what happens.
They're 26-2 in those clutch situations. So within five or less with five or less minutes to go, +44.8. So that's still, you know, pretty good. And and another dynamic that we didn't talk about in this that I tweeted about a little bit is that San Antonio losing today and the Warriors ending up pulling out that game makes the possibility that we discussed, I think it was in the preview for the Spurs-Warriors game, that I've been focusing on, which is the idea that the Warriors could have the number one seed clinched or functionally clinched by the time they play their next game, because that would give Popovich enough latitude to rest his starters a little bit more and make that game less competitive for the Warriors if they're still going for the win, for the wins record.
Yeah, that is Thursday, April 7th, the next time they play, and then they play that Saturday as well on the back end of a back-to-back. The Warriors now 97% chance at the top seed. They are projected by 538 for that 73-9 record. The Spurs projected for 68-14 after that loss.
Slackers.
So, with that being the case, you have to imagine if there is five games difference, that will not be competitive. And we'll see how hard Pop wants to go. I would imagine that based on everything that we know about him, that he probably would not want to. I mean, the only reason to go hard would be to fix it so the Spurs were the only team that went undefeated at home if they can get there. I mean, that'll be probably the biggest drama in those games down the end of the year now. Other than, of course, the Warriors going for the record. That might be dramatic.
Yeah, it's entirely possible now that both teams could go undefeated at home the same year.
All right, let's call it quits for today. But you have about 8 million things that you want to plug, starting with a podcast that I am probably going to listen to as soon as I get off here with Jonathan Abrams talking about his new book.
Yes, so Jonathan Abrams wrote a book called Boys Among Men, which is about the guys that made the jump from high school to the pros, mostly on the Kevin Garnett to LeBron James and plus a couple of years era. And so we have a conversation on that, and also we talk a little bit about how working on the book made him think about the age limit, because it's an issue that he's thought about and he's been talking to these high school kids to make the jump. And we also talk about, you know, why he wrote the book and the challenges of that, because he's been a feature writer for Grantland, New York Times, LA Times. And so that was a great conversation. Also had an off-season preview for the Toronto Raptors, which is, I think, one of the more underrated, important off seasons out there. And then the Warriors Weekly piece this week, I wrote about the Spurs game, which we've, of course, talked about at length.
Yeah, your podcast must be doing pretty well because Abrams did Simmons in the same week that he did you. So that's looking good. All right, I'm rambling here. Let's get going. Postmates, Cat Space Code to support the program. Follow us on Twitter, Nate Duncan NBA and Danny LaRue. iTunes review or rating, another great way to support the pod. We'll be back tomorrow. Talk to you then.